final numbers will be provided from the United States Secret Service. I think you can expect to see somewhere upwards beyond 20,000 members of the National Guard that will be here in the footprint of the District of Columbia.
Washington, D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti yesterday describing the military presence in the nation's capital next week when Joe Biden will take the oath of office and become the 46th president of the United States. For some context, that is four times the number of troops currently in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. On Inauguration Day, the National Mall will be closed. The Secret Service is taking all kinds of precautions to prevent another violent assault. It's not just in D.C. either. State capitals across the country are bracing for demonstrations or armed insurrection. Here in California, the Highway Patrol and the Sacramento Police are ramping up security around the Capitol. A 6-foot perimeter fence went up this morning. And CHP even denied a conservative group a permit to rally at the Capitol over the weekend. California Governor Gavin Newsom said Monday he is prepared to activate the California National Guard if need be.
Everybody is on, I think, a high alert in terms of just making sure that everybody is safe and protected. People's free speech can be advanced, but there's no violence.
We're going to talk about all this now with Garrett Graff. He's a journalist, historian, and he works on cybersecurity issues at the Aspen Institute. Welcome back to Press Play, Garrett.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you wrote just today that as the country prepares for more violence, there is a dangerous leadership vacuum at the top of the pyramid, at the agencies that are supposed to keep us safe at the federal level. What's happening?
Historically, presidential transitions, presidential inaugurations are always one of the most fraught and security-conscious moments in American calendar. And never before since 9/11 have we ever gone into a presidential transition with an acting attorney general, an acting Department of Homeland Security secretary, or an acting Secretary of Defense. This year, we actually have all three positions vacant. None of them have been in their jobs for more than a few weeks. And actually, the Department of Homeland Security secretary has only been in his job for a matter of hours after acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf resigned at the end of Monday night. So this is a very challenging moment for the U.S. government. It's a very threatening landscape for all of the reasons that listeners just heard. And yet the U.S. government has never had the level of vacancies and temporary officials overseeing its national security agencies as it does right now. Four of the seven largest federal law enforcement agencies have temporary leaders right now. And in fact, ICE's director, the third largest federal law enforcement agency, quit last night after just 2 weeks on the job, meaning that this morning, the eighth acting ICE director started this morning.
Oh, wow. And is part of the reason why the National Guard wasn't called up quickly enough last week was, by the Department of Defense, is that because of all of this vacancy and turmoil and overturning of jobs? Is that because there is a new, relatively new Secretary of Defense? Is that one of the reasons?
Obviously, there are going to be all sorts of investigations, and we're going to know a lot more about the decision-making that went into the colossal, abysmal strategic failure of the Capitol Police to do their most basic job last Wednesday. What we do know right now is that it seems like there were probably at least three different major factors at play. One was the police departments underestimated the level of violence and the size of the crowds that they were going to face. Why that happened seems like a massive strategic intelligence failure. The second is that there was some concern about the legacy of last summer's protests in the wake of George Floyd, the sense that they wanted to maintain a lighter footprint of federal troops, of federal law enforcement in the Capitol to avoid the types of overreaction that we saw last summer that was just as controversial in a different direction. The third factor is in some ways the most troubling, which is it seems like that there was a very real issue of race and politics at play in the security response last week. That the fact that this was mostly white protesters, that this was, that they were backed by the president, that this was a Republican crowd, seems to have caused security officials to downplay their own response. And both at the strategic level and then sort of minute by minute, hour by hour, as the siege at the Capitol unfolded last week. I mean, many people have pointed out, including Joe Biden, it's hard to imagine that a Black Lives Matter crowd would have been able to storm past the Capitol Police as nonviolently as this white crowd did.
And even in some cases, allowing them in. Opening the door for them, taking selfies with them in some cases. I'm wondering, today the Washington Post reported that dozens of people on the terrorist watch list were at this rally. And I know hundreds of thousands of people are on this terrorist watch list to begin with, but what does that tell you about how unprepared or unprepared in many ways our federal agencies were for what happened?
Yeah, and I think that this intersects with a story that we have seen federal law enforcement agencies and officials warning about over the last year, which is that the rise of white nationalist, white supremacist extremist groups is in many ways the biggest domestic terrorism threat to the United States right now. And so, as you said, it's hard to know what to read into the fact that so many people who were on that terrorist watch list showed up in the Capitol last week, because there are so many different ways that people end up on that list. It is not necessarily a particularly well-vetted or well-policed list. But what it does say is that there were a lot of people who have known ties to white supremacist organizations, white nationalist organizations, and that is worrisome in the context of the types of violence we might see on an ongoing basis continuing past the presidential inauguration next week.
Meanwhile, members of Congress are talking about investigating some members of their own body. I want to play this bite from a Facebook Live video that New Jersey Democratic Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill made with a pretty startling accusation.
Those members of Congress who had groups coming through the Capitol that I saw on January 5th, a reconnaissance for the next day.
Okay, so she's a graduate of the Naval Academy. She spent about 10 years on active duty, and she also worked as a Russian policy officer. And she's saying that, look, there are some members of Congress, she didn't name who they were actually giving tours, if you will, or reconnaissance, as she says, to people who were involved in the insurrection the next day.
Yeah, and I think we are going to find very close ties, perhaps even worrisome ties between members of Congress on the far right. This is a freshman class that has multiple members of it who are adherents of the very vague and false QAnon conspiracy theory cult. This is a group that we have seen people, we saw people like the new Congresswoman Boebert from Colorado, who has been making a big deal about carrying her Glock pistol around the Capitol, that she was tweeting that morning before the rally, "This is 1776," encouraging supporters that this is a ride or die moment. And that I think we are going to see many worrisome ties between certain factions of the Republican Party and the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th.
And so are we talking about censure or expulsion of those members?
I don't know that that's going to be all that's on the table. I think one of the things that we're going to see the Justice Department looking really hard at is incitement charges, insurrection charges. We're seeing the FBI and other federal law enforcement agencies right now rounding up protesters by the dozen. But all we have really seen right now are the low-hanging fruit charges, you know, the unlawful entry, the vandalism, the, you know, the firearms charges that are easily proven. And it seems very clear that many of these protesters and potentially others are going to face more serious charges as more evidence gets gathered, up to and including the people who helped incite this event in the first place.
Well, Garrett, thanks for coming on the show today. It's always great to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Garrett Graff, journalist and historian. Well, as big tech is cracking down on far-right extremists, where are they going now to communicate and to organize? Millions are now using encrypted apps like Signal and Telegram, which were built for people to communicate freely and not worry about being monitored by repressive governments or the police. But now they are the latest platforms for right-wing organizing. Proud Boys founder Gavin McInnes kicked off Twitter and Facebook, said he is now using Telegram and will be posting regularly there. Here to talk about all this is April Glazer. She's a tech investigations reporter for NBC News, and she's been following this story for some years now. Hi, April.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about Telegram. What is it?
Sure. So Telegram is an app. It's based in Dubai, but it was actually started by a Russian developer in an attempt to kind of create a platform that would be free of censorship. The person who originally created it created a social network that was much like Facebook in Russia, but it was quickly co-opted by the Russian government. So he wanted to create a platform where people could kind of post anything freely without fear of censorship. So as a result, it's been a haven both for people, you know, seeking to speak freely about human rights concerns in various countries where they can't, but also more recently, it's been a place where people who are engaging in hate, particularly in the United States, are congregating as well because of the lack of censorship and really just the lack of moderation on the platform. One more thing to note about Telegram is that it has both a public and a private function. You can both send encrypted private messages to people, and that encryption is supposedly very strong. But you can also have a public page, and that's where the far right has really congregated. So people like Gavin McInnes, as you mentioned, the founder of the Proud Boys, has a public page on Telegram where he can post and people can follow him and follow what he says.
So people who were on Parler, which went dead this week, that they would maybe migrate to Telegram for
right.
their public
so
pages?
So Parler, which was an app that got booted off the app stores both for Apple and Google, and it's really hard to have an app for, you know, a mobile phone that's not available in either place because then nobody can download it. So that app is kind of no longer working for folks. You know, now those people moved to Telegram, hoping to continue to engage, continue to have groups where they can organize and discuss. But now that Parler is no longer a place, they went somewhere else. And it makes sense that they would migrate. I mean, if the place where you were formerly congregating kicked you out or no longer worked, you'd go somewhere else. And they went to Telegram.
And they're also going to Signal, which is more of a text messaging service, right?
Right. So I use Signal all the time. Signal is just a very basic text messaging service, although you can have group messages. But what differentiates Signal from iMessage or, you know, the text message on an Android phone is that it offers encryption between carriers. So, you know, I can have an encrypted message between an Apple device and an Android device. Telegram allows for that too, but Signal does not have the same public posting options that Telegram has. So it's not really a social network in the same way Telegram is. It's just a text messaging service.
And numbers-wise, since the events of last Wednesday, are we seeing a huge increase in people on both of these sites, services?
Millions. You know, just this week on Tuesday, I believe Telegram said it added more than 25 million users over the previous 3 days. Right. Signal, I think it was just a couple days ago, went from 10 million downloads in one day on Android to something like 50 million. So just tremendous increases in downloads, and people are reporting, getting notifications that, you know, their relatives, people who aren't that tech savvy, are joining Signal or are joining this app that was previously kind of a place for people who were very privacy conscious, like journalists, like myself,
yeah,
who needed to communicate with sources.
Right. Well, I guess this is proving to be a problem for law enforcement as they're trying to assess what's in store in the next few days by these groups. If they can't monitor what they're saying, how can they know what they're up to?
Yeah, that's always the concern. You know, as when you deplatform, which is the word for when, let's say, a Facebook group gets shut down or somebody gets kicked off YouTube, or for Parler, the entire app gets kicked off. When you deplatform a piece of technology or a group, then, you know, the people who were organizing there previously have to regroup and go somewhere else. So they will go somewhere else. And if they go somewhere else, it's harder to monitor. Then it's harder for law enforcement or journalists or anyone else keeping track to watch their activities and report on what's happening. But at the same time, when you deplatform, these groups are less strong, right? They have to regroup. They have to find each other again. And so, you know, deplatforming does work in the sense that if you don't want to be providing a platform and a haven and a place for those who are organizing violence and organizing hate and encouraging hate, then yeah, kick them off. But then the reverse of that is they'll go to private places. The thing is, though, is that these private places often take a bit more tech savvy. You know, it's much easier to find someone on YouTube and gain a large following than it is on Telegram. Telegram works, but it's not that easy. It's not as easy to use as, say, Facebook, right? The UX isn't as clean. And also, you have to download a whole new app, so you're unlikely to get as many people. So you do reduce the following of folks, but then the reverse of that is, yeah, there's organizing in private. I'll also add that folks are organizing in private already anyway. So, you know, the argument there is not as strong because, you know, if they really wanted to organize in private, Signal's been around for years, and it's likely they were already using that.
Hmm. Well, what is the responsibility, or what have they said, these companies, Telegram and Signal, in terms of kicking these people off if they are posting violent content?
Well, Signal isn't a social media platform. It'd be like if iMessage kicked someone off for sending a text, right? So that's not as much in the category of Signal. But with Telegram, they do have a social media platform in many ways because they have these public pages where people can post and gain thousands and thousands of followers. So, you know, Telegram has been under the microscope a lot more since people have been migrating to it and has had to do what it's been very reticent to do or refused to do in the past, which is really delete or remove the overtly violent and hateful groups that have been on the app for years. You know, I've been reporting on Telegram for a few years now and have, you know, sent messages to the company asking them in my reporting, you know, I found this happening on your platform. What are you going to do? And got nothing back. Well, now that they're getting so much press, so many more downloads, and also now that Apple and Google are enforcing their terms of service against hate, are having to act a bit more, and they're working to remove these groups.
All right. Thank you, April. Thanks for the update.
Thanks so much, Madeline.
That's April Glazer. She's tech investigations reporter for NBC News. Coming up, the military has a hate group problem. We're going to find out more next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. U.S. military veterans were among the mob of Trump supporters storming the halls of Congress last week. Ashley Babbitt, the San Diego woman who was shot and killed during the riot, served in the Air Force. So did Larry Rendell Brock, who was photographed inside the Senate chambers carrying zip ties and has since been arrested. And the shirtless guy with the giant horns, Jake Angeli. He's former Navy. To the Pentagon, the fact that ex-military members were involved in the Capitol riots is not surprising. Just last month, Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller ordered a review of current policy around extremist and hate group activity within the military. But with more than a million active duty members and 18 million veterans, Where should the Pentagon begin to address this? Brian Bender is senior national correspondent for Politico. He wrote about this, and he joins me now. Hi.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. Well, it seems every day we're finding out that more veterans were involved in this crazy insurrection at the Capitol. Were you surprised to see so many people who are military veterans doing that?
You know, I think all of us were surprised by the whole thing. But as you pointed out, as more information came out about some of the people involved in breaching the Capitol, including what seemed to be some of the ringleaders, had military ties, I think was a little surprising. But if you consider the issue that, you know, the military has kind of dealt with this on and off for years, usually things seem fine, but then there's a couple of incidents where extremists in the ranks either do things or say things and everybody focuses on it again. And what a lot of the experts tell us is that the rise of extremist viewpoints in the military tends to mirror rises in society at large. So if there's more of this going on in the wider population, it tends to seep more heavily into the military. And a lot of the right-wing groups, anti-government militias, for example, tend to recruit people that have military experience, either people already in the military or those who come out of the military. And I think it's important to make that distinction. These were all former military people. And so it's not clear yet whether they had some of these views while they were in service or whether they developed them while they came out. One of the things the Pentagon talks about is that people are getting radicalized perhaps while they're in the military.
They're getting radicalized while they're in the military, so they're not radical before joining the military. What in the military radicalizes them?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, what radicalizes anybody? There's obviously a lot of opportunities, whether it's online or through other means, to be exposed to some of these viewpoints. And, you know, some of these groups do tend to target people in the military. It, you know, it's not that, you know, there's an army of extremists that are hiding in the U.S. military. I think the concern is that it's still a small percentage, but it's a little bit more virulent. It's growing in numbers. And like it's society at large, perhaps there are people in the military who feel like it's a more permissible environment for these kinds of ideas. So the Pentagon, like you said, a month ago, had started to address this issue because I think people were sounding the alarm. And so the Pentagon is actually right now engaged in a series of things to try and get a better handle on how serious the problem is. Do they have the right procedures in place, the right training to spot these people? What are the signs that there might be people with these extremist views in the military branches? And what do we need to do about it? And are there ways to prevent people from becoming radicalized so they don't leave the military and then, like we saw last week, go play prominent roles in some of the illegal activities?
Right. And so one group that specifically recruits members of the military or ex-members of the military is the Oath Keepers, a right-wing militarized extremist group. What is their stated reason for wanting military members or ex-military members in their ranks? Like, what do they want to do with that knowledge and training and expertise?
Well, you know, some of these groups, and you can't really lump them all together, you know, they have some commonalities. They have usually very racist views, ideological driven. They're also very anti-government. And, you know, if you're an anti-government militia or you don't believe that the U.S. government is legitimate and you think it needs to be overthrown, then obviously you're going to want people who have some skills who maybe potentially know how to do that.
Well, isn't there a kind of an irony there? I mean, here they are recruiting people who are trained by the government itself to overthrow the government. I mean, or to at least they are fighting against the current idea of the government. So, I mean, there is an irony there, don't you think?
There's an irony there. But at the same time, you could look at it as, you know, sort of the ultimate coup. In other words, we're going to get the best and the brightest from within that illegitimate government. We're going to brainwash them. We're going to change their views and bring them to our side.
Huh. So it's kind of surprising if this has been going on for a long time, and not just for the last 4 years, but for a while longer than that, that the Pentagon really doesn't have any idea about the extent to which some of its members have been radicalized.
Well, I think on the one hand, it's difficult to spot some of these elements within the military. In other words, you know, we live in a day and age where you're probably not going to flaunt it. You're not going to walk through the mess hall, you know, wearing a Nazi SS tattoo or display your sympathies overtly. And so that means that commanders at lower levels need to be aware of the signs. They need to be aware of where their soldiers are going online, what, you know, subscriptions are they signing up for. All the experts will say it's the kind of issue that needs constant vigilance and needs to be understood at all levels of command that this is an issue that we need to be aware of. And like a lot of institutions, you know, it gets into crisis mode when something pops up. You know, a soldier is found, for example, like, you know, Florida National Guardsman, it turned out a couple of years ago, had founded a neo-Nazi group. Obviously, once that came to light, they took action. It's like the problem in society at large. It rears its ugly head. You do something about it, but then you sort of go about your business, and you know, years could go by where you're not necessarily being vigilant. And I think that's where people say we are right now, where this is an issue that's kind of languished.
Well, a lot of these groups were activated, radicalized when Barack Obama became president, first Black president. A lot of people didn't like that. And I'm wondering if the next Secretary of Defense, retired General Lloyd Austin, who's Black, if he's confirmed as next Secretary of Defense, what could that spark in terms of a reaction within the military?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, I think it's definitely on people's minds. But, you know, I guess I look at it this way, which is the military is a very diverse organization. And I mean, obviously, there are a lot of African-Americans in the military, Latinos, all kinds of people from all kinds of walks of life. And so writ large, the institution knows that these viewpoints are bad. They know that it's eroding the military. And so they're willing to do something about it. So I think if General Austin comes in and he makes this a priority, and I think most people think he will, people will follow his lead. And, you know, the military, that's one good thing about the institution, which is you have to follow orders. So if there are new procedures in place, new training in place to try and get a better handle on this issue, I think people will get in line.
Brian Bender is senior national correspondent for Politico. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why Black men are especially vulnerable to COVID. The effects of a lifetime of stress make their bodies more vulnerable to disease.
So, right, we're all under stress in the pandemic, but this is a very particular type of stress that's related to racism.
How COVID is hollowing out a generation of Black men, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's a cliche now that viruses don't discriminate when it comes to the people they infect. But with COVID, that's not exactly true. Men are more likely to die than women. Black people die at higher rates than white people. That means this disease is especially dangerous for Black men. Washington Post healthcare reporter Akilah Johnson investigated what that's doing to an entire generation of Black men for a recent ProPublica article, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Well, fine, thank you. And let's just get the statistics out of the way before we talk about the people that you met and the people that you profiled. The CDC says African Americans are about 1.5 times more likely to get COVID than white people, 4 times more likely to be hospitalized, and about 3 times more likely to die. And so that's pretty stark. In general, what are the reasons for that disparity?
You know, when I was reporting this article, when I was at ProPublica, One of the things that really became apparent is that you've got increased exposure risk. So the way that society is structured puts Black people at a higher risk of exposure. And then because of some of those same structural barriers, it puts you at increased risk of having worse outcomes when you get COVID-19. So what does that mean? Mm-hmm. That means that you have jobs that put you at a higher risk for having to actually be out in the world and working. So you're not sitting behind a computer all day clicking refresh, or, you know, have the ability to work from home. You have to use public transit to get to and from work. Folks are living in multi-generational households. People have less access to healthcare. So you've got a myriad of reasons that increase your risk to exposure, which can lead you to increase hospitalization and increase infection rate. You know, once you're infected and you're hospitalized, some of those same kind of structural issues create worse health outcomes once you have COVID, because you have increased comorbidity. So hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular issues, lung issues. And what our reporting found is that a lot of these conditions are stress related. And it's a very particular type of stress that stems from being Black and being Black men in America. So, right, we're all under stress in the pandemic, but this is a very particular type of stress that's related to racism.
And you call this particular kind of stress, or the kind of person who is experiencing this kind of stress, you refer to a theory called John Henryism. And I just want you to first describe exactly what that is. What is the legend of John Henry?
Right. So the tale goes that he's, you know, John Henry was a steel driving man who died with a hammer in his hand. So he took on and competed against the steam drill, which at the time was used to kind of blast through the sides of mountains to build the railroad. And he beat the steam drill with this hammer in his hand, but he fell down and died from the sheer exhaustion and effort of it. It is quite often referred to and seen as this legend of resilience, of, you know, being able to tackle and succeed in the face of insurmountable odds. But what is quite often not talked about nearly as much is the other truth that is buried within that legend. And it's that effort and the exertion of overcoming and striving to take on the machine killed him in the end. And so the legend of John Henry and the public health theory of John Henryism derives its name from that. And it was coined by an epidemiologist named Dr. Sherman James.
Well, when you're talking about the legend of John Henry and the fact that all this hard work is killing Black people, Black men, who are you talking about in general? Are you talking about working class Black men, white collar workers, all Black men in general?
So, you know, when Dr. James first started, when he first started researching this hypothesis back in the late 70s, it was really something that was presenting itself in working class African American men, but more so working class African Americans, because he is quick to point out that this is not gender specific, nor is it class specific. Because what happens is, in the striving to overcome these barriers, you have what's called weathering. So it begins to physically change the body, right? The stress begins to physically change the body at the chromosomal level. And that manifests in men as well as women. It starts in the womb and it continues throughout your life. One of the things that a lot of the researchers said to us is, you know, you don't wake up 30 and weathered. It is a progressive thing that starts when you are in utero and continues, unfortunately, until you die.
So what's interesting is that we've all heard that older people are more susceptible to COVID and to dying of COVID and to having serious complications due to COVID. And I guess what you're saying with the weathering is relatively young people, because of the weathering, maybe their physiology is more that of an older person. And is that one reason why they're getting sicker and dying more of COVID? Because their bodies are actually older than they are chronologically?
That was one of the findings that the reporting produced and that we saw, is in Black people, some of these chronic health conditions that puts you in a position to have a worse outcome from COVID present 10 years earlier. So hypertension presents 10 years earlier in Black people than it does in white people. And then researchers found similar situation with COVID-19. And so that is part of the kind of call to action that some of these researchers are saying is that in terms of next steps and treatments and what can be done is to begin to test folks earlier because of this kind of weathering that takes place and how it ages the body.
Right. Tell us about a man you reported on named Leslie Lamar Parker of Minneapolis. He died at the age of 31, so pretty young. And how is he an example of what you're talking about with John Henryism?
Leslie is really interesting. His kind of John Henryism situation, as they say, started early when he was in school. He, you know, was the class clown, constantly challenging authority. And his mom will tell you it's not because he wasn't bright or it wasn't because he wasn't smart. It's because he was bored and he wasn't being challenged in class. And he just kind of didn't see the point. Like school didn't hold his attention. And so he wasn't on track to graduate. Black boys in particular and Black children in general are quite often seen as not being as smart as some of their contemporaries. You know, teachers assume that they are not going to graduate and go on to college. And so you're faced with these kind of systemic barriers built into the education system that he was able to overcome. He goes to college, he falls in love, they get pregnant, he drops out of college, they get married, but he still goes back to school and gets his bachelor's degree, all the while raising a family. You know, he eventually begins to help raise some of his younger cousins. And as he's doing this, he's also constantly having to be vigilant against stereotypes of Black men because Leslie is tall. You know, he's large. He's overweight, which a lot of these men were overweight, which is what we found is that stress and the kind of constant assault on your system from stress hormones can, you know, wreak havoc on a variety of your body's functions, and it can cause you to and can cause weight gain. So he's constantly vigilant against how people are looking at a large Black man as he navigates the world and moves through the world, and not just the world writ large, but mostly white spaces, because he is in Minnesota, which is an overwhelmingly white state. You know, his wife said he was so sensitive to stereotypes of absent Black fathers that he was a present parent on steroids. And, you know, it got to the point where he was so cognizant of that he would dress in what one of the researchers referred to as kind of like a non-threatening Black guy uniform. So he's consciously in the morning when he goes to school, because he also worked in an elementary school, when he goes to school, when he goes to work, when he's moving through the world, of putting on clothes that would disarm people around him. So he wore a lot of shirts that were conversation starters. You know, he carried his SpongeBob backpack with him. And that is a really particular type of stress and a particular type of anxiety. And mm-hmm. I think about Leslie's story quite a bit. I traveled to the suburbs of Minneapolis for his memorial service in September and keep one of the keepsakes that they gave away, a bookmark with his picture on my desk, to kind of remind me of the impact of what's lost and the reason for writing this story and just what his family and even, you know, his coworkers, what they saw when they looked at Leslie versus what Leslie was very well aware of and cognizant of how people who didn't know him, what they saw.
Hmm. And so he was so young when he died of COVID. And your article is titled How COVID-19 Hollowed Out a Generation of Young Black Men. Are we losing a generation of Black men to this disease? That seems almost inconceivable. Why isn't that alarming more people?
You know, that is definitely the fear of all of the researchers that I spoke to. And there's actually some research that we found that COVID is actually shortening life expectancy. You know, and Black men already have the shortest life expectancy of any American demographic. And COVID is taking years from people. And it should be particularly distressing for everybody that we are in the middle of a pandemic almost what are we, a year out, that is continuing to wreak havoc on these communities of color who are bearing this desperate brunt of what's happening. And so it is definitely something that everybody should not just be aware of, but then should be taking those next steps to think about, how do we fix this? How do we mitigate this? How do we make it so that there aren't other families like the families in this article who are contending with this overwhelming loss that just really is beyond imagination in some ways?
Yeah. I want to thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for your story on this. Fascinating.
Thank you. I appreciate the time and appreciate the ability to talk about it.
Yeah. Akilah Johnson is a Washington Post reporter who covers the intersection of race and health in science. She co-reported an article in ProPublica called How COVID-19 Hollowed Out a Generation of Young Black Men. Coming up, believe it or not, it is time to think about your spring garden. Evan Kleinman is here with tips on what to plant and how to do it, even if you don't have a backyard. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Okay, we're in a cleansing mood, so let's talk plants. Specifically, home gardens where you can grow your own delicious food. All you need are some seeds, soil, a little sunlight, and tons of patience. And you'll get some great homegrown vegetables. Here with me is Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food, with some tips to get the most out of your garden. Hi.
Hi.
Well, Happy New Year. And what kind of garden are you recommending today?
So, you know, I have a house that has some space in the backyard, but almost all of it is concrete. So I grow all my plants in containers, and people can grow containers pretty much anywhere. And for this time of year, the kind of plants that we can grow, you don't even need containers that are that big. You know, once you get into the plants that you plant later on in the spring that will come to fruition in summer, your tomatoes, your peppers, those you need really deep containers. But, you know, for the things we can grow now, you don't need things that are that big.
And do you start from seed, or do you start from a tiny seedling or a tiny little plant?
Well, I'm one of those people that gets very seduced by seed catalogs. So I always start some things from seed, but I'm still not a great from seed gardener. I'm determined this year to crack that nut. So typically I do rely on seedlings, and we're very lucky in LA because there are a few places to get really quality seedlings and that you'll have good success with. And by using seedlings, you basically save yourself like between 1 to 2 months. Because that's how long it takes for a seed to get as big as a seedling is.
So what kind of container would you need if you wanted to start from seedling and go all the way up to edible plants?
So if you're talking about the things that we can plant now, which are lettuces, pretty much every kind of green, brassicas, herbs. For lettuces and herbs, you could even use a pot that's 8 inches deep, which is, you know, really surprising. You want to make sure that if it's something you've used before, you want to make sure it's really clean so you're not carrying over any fungal diseases that might be lurking in there. You want to make sure you have a really good, preferably organic, potting soil. You can't just dig up dirt that's around your house and throw it in a pot. It's too heavy. You need something that's light so you get really good drainage.
And you can plant lettuces now? I associate lettuce with the spring.
Yes, you can. You can plant lettuces now. You will eat them in the spring. If you start from seed, then it'll take about 30 to 40 days, depending upon the kind of thing that you're planting. So, for example, winter vegetables that people are harvesting now, like cauliflower, broccoli, cabbage, those were planted at the end of summer, the beginning of fall.
Hmm. So what should we be planting now? The lettuces?
So now you can really start with everything that you imagine you're going to eat in spring. So all the greens, peas, every kind of pea. I also really want to encourage people to plant flowers, because if you're planting vegetables, what is it to just get another pot and throw a couple flower seeds or seedlings in there? It's mm-hmm. really, really changes your mood. And don't we all need that right now?
Yeah. And what a lovely surprise amongst all that green to see some color.
Right. So you can plant leeks. I'm a little behind. I could have planted these in the fall, but from seed, I have things like cabbage, broccoli rabe, Chinese broccoli that I'm planting for the first time, and a different kind of kale already in my pots growing that I'm harvesting that I planted several weeks ago are a couple different kinds of mustards and dandelions, as mm-hmm. well as some kale.
I have a couple of boxes in my backyard that I filled with some beautiful soil and planted some. I didn't go from seed. I went from the little small plants. And so I was very excited about it until the other day I looked out and I saw the cat in there. Because
yes,
what a great litter box. does that mean all of my plantings are ruined?
I would change out your soil. Yeah, I would change out your soil. And then, you know, you can go online and see what works best as a cat preventative. But I would imagine a ton of ground pepper, either red or black, would help with that situation.
Yeah, just the idea of them getting that on their paws. I'm sure they don't like that.
Exactly. But yeah, I really encourage people who have never gardened before to start with seedlings. And I'd like to give a shout out to one place in particular that I think is unique and really high quality, and that is Logan's Garden. Logan is Jimmy Williams' son. Many of us have known him as a plant guy for years. Logan has a thriving seedling business. He shows up every week at the Hollywood Farmers Market and also the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And he has lots of different kinds of varieties of everything we've talked about. And they're really beautifully grown, and you will have excellent success with them. Jimmy and Logan have what I believe to be the only Black-owned nursery in Southern California. And they're just great guys. Logan's a pleasure.
And I guess you could go to his nursery, too, if you wanted to.
You can go to his nursery. I don't know what his COVID situation is right now. And if, you know, you really want to splash out a little bit, I asked him if they're still taking on private clients, and he said yes. He has never put in so many gardens as he is right now.
Hmm. And why is that? Because we can get our vegetables, and we can get good CSA deliveries of organic vegetables. I mean, it's not hard to get good vegetables here
for
in
me,
LA.
For me, I have to say gardening isn't so much about the product as the process. There is something for me about being in my backyard, puttering around, digging in the soil, watering, just, you know, having this relationship with these growing things and seeing how they change from day to day. I also happen to be unbelievably lazy. So if I happen to have enough plant material in the backyard that I can just, you know, make myself a last minute pasta from what I have out there, all the better.
Okay, laziness wins the day. Evan Kleiman, host of KCRLV's Good Food, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
And that will do it for us today on another not so lazy, Dave. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever and wherever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.